Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA. Recently, an historical exhibition opened to deeply emotional reviews in New York City. Its subject, the quite extensive involvement of New York in the slave trade, shocked many New Yorkers, who thought that slavery's evils were confined to the South. In a very real sense, New Yorkers have had the evidence of slavery at their feet for centuries. There are extensive burial grounds of slaves beneath the streets of the city. The men, women, and children whose bondage ended in those graves still offer testimony about the lives they led. Their stories come to us through the efforts of scholars and scientists, determined that their long silent voices be heard and added to the sweeping narrative of American history. My guest is Dr. Edna Greene Medford of the African Burial Ground Project at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Medford, welcome to Dialogue.
My pleasure.
Dr. Medford, I look forward, and I think everyone listening does, to hearing much more about this project. But let's begin by you telling us its purpose or purposes in your view. What is it intending to do?
Well, the scholars certainly were attempting to give voice to a group of people who certainly during their lifetimes were not able to speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so we had the opportunity to study their remains and to study the documentary history, the documentation that was left behind on their lives and labor. And so we thought this was the perfect opportunity to speak about those lives through them.
Exactly. When did this begin?
In 1991, when the federal government was excavating for a new office building in Lower Manhattan, mm-hmm. they uncovered remains. They knew there was a cemetery there mm-hmm. all along, but they had assumed that there were no more remains left because that area, as you know, has undergone a tremendous building and construction right. over the several decades and centuries, for that matter. So I think it was a surprise to some that there were so many remains being pulled up. Mm-hmm. And so the descendant community in New York insisted that the work be halted there and something be done about giving a proper burial to the right. people who were being disinterred. Mm-hmm. And eventually what occurred was 419 sets of remains were brought to Howard University, and the remains were studied under the direction of Dr. Michael Blakey, who was the mm-hmm. scientific
oh,
director
of course. Mm-hmm.
and the project mm-hmm. director. And the historians at Howard, primarily at Howard, were involved in looking at documentation on
right.
the lives of the people who would have been interred in that cemetery.
Has their final report been published, or is that yet to occur?
The skeletal biology report, which is the biological anthropological section of the project, and the history report are both online. They mm-hmm. are available online. They have not been published beyond that, mm-hmm. however. And the archaeology report is in the process of being completed.
Let's talk about some of the things these fascinating reports reveal to us. I've looked at your reports, and one of the things that first struck me was a reference to the burial ground as, and I quote here, New York's first black institution. That's a fascinating phrase. What do you mean by that?
We called it the first black institution because it was ground that was controlled at least to some extent by African people. Because they were enslaved, they didn't have control over a lot. But that burial ground, we feel, gave them the opportunity mm-hmm. to control something, and something that was extremely important to them. There's nothing more important to a people than how they bury their dead.
Right.
It shows their humanity. And I think more than anything else, we saw that humanity in the way they put to rest the people that they loved.
That's fascinating. One of the obvious reasons it's fascinating is, as we, I think we've both alluded to, you are giving voice to people long mute and long dead and helping to explain their story. And that story is, of course, the story of slavery in New York. And I'd love to devote some attention in our conversation to precisely that, what mm-hmm. slavery was like. You know, in the popular imagination, we think of plantations and fields in the South. But I guess, Dr. Medford, the first question is, how would you characterize the kind of slavery that would have existed in a major urban capital like New York, even
mm-hmm.
then?
Mm-hmm. You know, slavery is slavery. And even though, you know, we think of, when we think of slavery, we think plantation slavery. Mm-hmm. It's unfree labor. It's exploitation of people. It's preventing them from exercising their rights as human beings. They are property. And certainly in New York, they had the same status. Whether they were under the Dutch or under the British, even though the Dutch did not codify slavery, mm-hmm. they still were treating Africans and African-descended people as if they were property.
Right.
And so their labor was exploited. There was, you know, concern about what they were doing at any given moment. So they were restricted in so many different ways that mm-hmm. human beings take for granted.
Yeah, they were distinctly unfree.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. I like the distinction you draw between the dimension you make of Dutch and English periods. I'd love to explore that briefly, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. But in terms of occupations, for example, again, when I think of the even then urban environment we're talking about, is it correct to think that they might have been more involved in trades and domestic work than would have been the case in the rural South, for example?
It actually does depend upon the time period, actually.
Okay.
So if you're talking about those African people who are laboring under the Dutch, they're doing everything. Remember, this is a frontier environment, and so they are clearing the land. They are building the fort. They're erecting other public works. They are farming, because, you know, we have to remember that New Amsterdam is not really an
That's
urban
right.
environment.
That's right.
And for that matter, neither is New York.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for a long period mm-hmm. of time, New York has its outward, and yeah. there it's a very rural area, and they are growing food
right.
Through a great deal of the 17th century. Mm-hmm. But they're doing everything imaginable in that village, mm-hmm. because it is a village initially, and when it becomes a city, their labor reflects the needs mm-hmm. of that kind of environment. It becomes a very important port city. Mm-hmm. And so they're serving on the docks, loading and unloading the ships and transporting goods throughout the city and doing any number of things. They're building ships. They're mm-hmm. serving as coopers. So they're building the barrels in which a lot of the products are shipped.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that's needed in that city, people of color are doing.
What you're telling me, I think, is that the history of slavery is the history of New York. I mean, it paces every phase and aspect of
There's no
the
doubt
city.
About it. There's no doubt
yeah.
about it. Those people built the city of New York.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And of course, they don't get their freedom. Slavery does not end until 1827.
Right.
So that's a long time
Indeed.
To labor.
You've already hinted at this. I'd love to for you to elaborate a bit on the distinctions you think we should keep in mind between the Dutch and the English mm-hmm. periods.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Dutch were not very clear, at least in law, what mm-hmm. the rights and responsibilities, so to speak, of enslaved people were. Mm-hmm. They didn't codify slavery.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that they didn't see them as enslaved people or that they didn't exploit their labor. They certainly did. And they made distinctions between African people and other people, because we have references to Dutch people, whites, being punished for breaking a law. And one of the punishments was that they would have to labor with the Negroes in chains. So that certainly does distinguish African mm-hmm. people from other people. And there was also reference to the whites not being able to associate with Negroes or with mm-hmm. blacks and with Indians and with people who were not Christians. So mm-hmm. there is definitely a distinction being made.
Right, whether it's codified or not.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So they're slaves in custom,
mm-hmm.
if not by law.
With the English, and of course the English are a later period, are they not?
Mm-hmm. They actually take over the settlement, the colony of New Netherland in 1664.
And do we get codification of slavery, or what do we get?
We get nearly immediate codification with the British. They leave nothing to chance. And we see very rigid laws as well when they come in.
Mm. The rigid laws of the English, and of course the very nature of slavery, which is detestable no matter what its basis is, lead us to some very interesting points brought out in your report that I'd love to get your insight on, and it concerns rebellion,
mm-hmm.
because in the
mm-hmm.
sense that contrary to opinions that some people may have, they did not, the slaves, take this meekly.
Absolutely not.
And there are many points, but a couple in particular I'd love to hear you talk about. In the early 18th century, 1712,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and then perhaps most dramatically, at least to me most intriguingly, 1741.
Yes.
What
yes.
happens?
In 1712, there is a bona fide revolt. They are so oppressed that mm-hmm. I think they finally explode, mm-hmm. and they try to do something about it. Of course, the rebellion is repressed very quickly. Mm-hmm. They're not successful, of course, and quite a few of them lose their lives as a consequence. And there are very repressive laws that are passed after the 1712 mm-hmm. revolt as well. The 1741 incident is a little more complicated. Mm-hmm. Historians have not agreed about whether or not that was really a revolt. Mm-hmm. They think that the English in New York they jumped to conclusions. They thought that the enslaved population was attempting to burn down the city, when in reality, what probably was happening was they were setting fires to sort of hide the fact that they were breaking into to people's homes and their businesses and so mm-hmm. forth. So the fires were a diversion, mm-hmm. Probably rather than some kind of outward attempt to revolt by arms. You know, mm-hmm. there are lots of ways to resist
exactly.
enslavement. Mm-hmm. And certainly the idea that they're breaking into people's homes and their shops and stealing is a form of resistance,
indeed.
You know.
Indeed.
So it may not be armed revolt, but mm-hmm. it certainly is telling their owners, we're not going to take this lying down. You know, mm-hmm. we have our own agenda, mm-hmm. and we're going to, our voices will be heard in that way.
And that must have shocked the English profoundly.
Oh, it definitely did. Mm-hmm. They were always so afraid about what was going to happen if there was an uprising.
Right.
Always very, very concerned about it. And concerned as well that there might be some kind of a plot with the French in the north, because you mm-hmm. had French Canada and the mm-hmm. whole Catholic thing and so forth, and there was a great deal of concern about Catholicism
right.
and all of that. So that's all tied up in it. Mm-hmm. There are some historians who believe it really was just, you know, fires to hide the fact that they were they had a theft ring going,
mm-hmm.
But there are others who believe that if not an actual armed revolt or attempt at revolt, they mm-hmm. certainly had every reason to be revolting.
Well, the one thing that's clear to me is that whatever it might have been, it definitely demonstrates, not just suggests, but demonstrates slaves were not passive.
Absolutely.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, Dr. Metford, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. My guest is Dr. Edna Green Medford of the African Burial Ground Project at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Medford, with your help, I'd like to turn us to the graves
mm-hmm.
themselves. I guess the questions are obvious, and they'd probably begin with this one. Who is in them?
40% of them are children of infant age.
Oh. Yeah.
50% of them are children under the age of 12.
Oh.
And so the population is fairly young. Mm-hmm. I believe only 2% of the burial ground population consisted of people who were over 55.
Mm-hmm.
So people died very early, especially young women between the mm-hmm. Ages of 15 and 25. Mm-hmm. And we think that that may have had something to do with the fact that they're of childbearing age, mm-hmm. so they have that added disadvantage. They're laboring very hard, and then they're also bearing children as mm-hmm. well, and they're simply not surviving.
Wasn't one young woman sort of mysteriously buried with a bullet wound?
Yes, there was a musket ball still mm-hmm. lodged in her chest. And she had, I believe, a fracture to her face. Her mm-hmm. face was sort of bashed in. And she had a fracture to her wrist as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the implication was that someone had handled her very severely, at least a week or so, I believe, before mm-hmm. she died. And so the musket ball, of course, did mm-hmm. the final deed. Of course, we don't have a clue who she was or what was involved in her death, mm-hmm. or how it came about. But
it's interesting. Do we have any identities?
No, we don't.
Uh-huh.
We don't.
What do we, I mean, the population is absolutely intriguing the way you've described it, the children and young women to such an extraordinary extent. What does the evidence tell us about their health conditions, the reasons for death? Nutrition, malnutrition, whatever it might have been?
There were so many pathologies that the anthropologist found mm-hmm. in each of the individuals. A great deal of dental issues mm-hmm. that show malnutrition, all kinds of infectious diseases, apparently. And I'm not a biological anthropologist, so I'm just extrapolating from the work of that team. Mm-hmm. But it's my understanding that there are certain kinds of illnesses that leave markers on the bones, on the remains. Mm-hmm. And so they found those on the bones. And so there are all kinds of infectious diseases. There was osteoarthritis. And as I understand it, that occurs because of repetitive labor, mm-hmm. you know, doing mm-hmm. the same thing over and over
and
again.
And this is in young
These are in young people, much younger than would have been expected.
Right, because that's the disease I at least think of with older
Absolutely.
Populations.
And that's mm-hmm. what was so extraordinary about mm-hmm. it.
Mm-hmm. I should have asked this earlier. We're talking about one site or are we talking about multiple sites? We're talking about that one site where the 417?
Yes, the 419 remains.
Right,
it's a small part mm-hmm. of the burial ground that was actually excavated. It's 5 or 6 acres.
Oh, really?
In all, and there was less than a block that was actually excavated. So we don't know either what part of that burial ground has been uncovered. We don't know if that's the oldest section of it because it's in existence uh-huh. for almost 100 years.
Right.
Maybe longer than that.
Right.
We have the first evidence of its use in 1712 in terms of the records.
Mm-hmm.
But we suspect that that burial ground may have been there since the 1640s.
Mm.
There was a population of black people living in the vicinity since the 1640s. They would have had to bury their dead somewhere. They had a couple of other possibilities, but it's more likely that they used that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very small area that has been uncovered. So we don't know what the rest of it is like. And extrapolating from the number of remains that were excavated from that area, anthropologists are indicating that it could be anywhere from 10 to 20,000 people buried in that entire cemetery.
My goodness.
It could be that many.
Great. We will probably never really know.
No, because we'll never have access to
that. The rest of it, exactly.
And that's, you know, mm-hmm. that's certainly understandable and acceptable,
mm-hmm.
you know. And we wouldn't have had access to this
mm-hmm.
if not for the construction that was going on. But it was a real... It was a real honor and a privilege to be a part of that team mm-hmm. because as an African American, mm-hmm. you know, I feel a connection to the people buried there that I wouldn't feel to any other population of people. So to be able to tell their story from their perspective was extremely important to us.
And deeply emotional.
Absolutely was. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity at the ceremony at Howard when we were returning the remains to New York. We had returned all but 4 sets of remains, and we had a ceremony on campus. And I had the opportunity to help carry in one of the sets of remains, and it was of a child.
Oh, dear.
And I think it didn't hit me until I was walking into the chapel with those remains. And I thought, what must that mother have thought when that child died, and what did that child die of? And as a mother, you can't help but think about those kinds of things. So it was definitely very emotional for all of us who worked on that project. And it still is, you know, to think about the lives of those people. It was also refreshing, though, to see how they lived, because they tried to do it their way. Even mm-hmm. though they were enslaved, they insisted that their humanity be recognized.
I'm so glad you share that with us. I really am. I hadn't expected that revelation, mm-hmm. quite frankly. Well, this last point you made, though, that they insisted on their humanity, even under inhumane circumstances, it ties into a curiosity I had. Over that period of time, which you've indicated that the burial practices went on decades, and centuries, really, mm-hmm. Do you detect, has the team been able to detect, customs and rites or indications, perhaps, of African mm-hmm. Derived customs in the burial, or I mean, what mm-hmm. kinds of things emerge in that way?
We have very little information from the documentary evidence mm-hmm. of what their rituals were. We do know, though, that there's a 1712 reference to them burying their dead in on the common, accustomed to their country, the traditions of their country,
mm-hmm.
and there's a reference to mummeries and outcries. So the suggestion is that they're using language that is different
mm-hmm.
Than what would be expected of Europeans. What we attempted to do, because we knew so little from the records about their customs, was we went back to Africa and we looked at the societies from which they would have been drawn.
That was a question of mine, too. So you got into tribal distinctions?
It's very much a diasporic report. So we looked at Congo, Angola, and what kinds of practices they would have been doing during the period of the burial grounds, when people would have been coming into New York from those areas. We looked at West Africa and the practices of the various ethnic groups in that region. And we, although we don't have evidence that they followed any of those practices, at least not from the documentary evidence, we can assume that people who are coming don't lose everything.
Right.
You know, they're not totally stripped of their culture. Mm-hmm. They may not be allowed to speak their language. They may not be allowed to do certain things. But in their burial practices, I suspect they had some control. Mm-hmm. And there are some things that the archaeologists did discover. Mm-hmm. The woman who was buried with the waist beads. You know, that is a tradition. Mm. Certainly.
The corpse is facing in a particular direction to any extent?
No, I don't think that there was anything unusual about that at all. Mm-hmm. No, we wondered as well. And we looked at things like how many would have been in coffins and how many not, how they were buried, if there were pieces of cloth that were still left and so forth. But I don't believe they've been able to determine very much from that. I may be wrong. Mm-hmm. The archaeologists may very well have, in their final report, may be able to determine something.
Well, Dr. Medford, this has been an extraordinary conversation, not just for the scholarly information you revealed, but for the personal dimension of it, and I deeply appreciate that very much. Very happily informed to get that,
thank
I
you
guess
so
that's
much.
The word indeed.
Thank you.
And as we come to the end, I think it would be appropriate if you just said a brief word about the project's immediate future and perhaps the website or however people can get information I know you want them to have.
Mm-hmm. The website address is www.africanburialground.gov. And what we're hoping to do is to produce an integrated work that will blend the history, the anthropology, and the archaeology all into one so that we can really tell the complete story. Because we can't do much without the other. The anthropology means nothing without the history background, and certainly the archaeology is absolutely crucial to all of this. So if we could have that that final piece, everyone wants to do that. So we're hoping that will happen.
I join you in that hope. I thank you for this conversation, and I recommend to listeners that they do indeed go to that website. I'm also glad to know that you'll be coming back for further programs with us. Thank you so much,
Dr.
Medford.
Thank you.
It's not often that I'm moved to offer an afterword to a dialogue conversation, but today is such an occasion. Edna Medford's very gripping account of the African Burial Site Project reminded me of all those mute voices that may now be heard, and of the cruel and perverted world they inhabited in life. Now those thoughts turned me to an earlier dialogue conversation with author Edward P. Jones on his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Known World. In it, through the power of his imagination, he answers a question that has haunted me always. Generations of slaves found the strength to survive the evil that surrounded them. How did they do it? Here are excerpts from that conversation. And I want to read a sentence to you about that you've said about slavery and see how it's reflected in the book and your thought. It's a question that might have haunted you, it probably did as you wrote this, and it goes this way. What is it like for a people to become invisible in a country that the world sees as offering hope and promises to so many others? Mm. And for those who are really concerned about the place of slavery in our history, that seems to me like a very powerful evocation of what its cost was.
Yeah. It's always this great irony with this country, given, you know, the principles upon which it was founded and the way, you know, so over the centuries, so many people have not lived up to those principles. Mm-hmm. Then they speak out one side of their mouth and then turn around and do something entirely contrary to what they just said. That was one of my interests. But I know I was also interested in just how people managed to survive such a horrendous situation. And I didn't even realize that that was in my head until after the woman who became my editor had read it and sent it back to me and had very, very few suggestions about things. Mm-hmm. And I decided to take as fresh an eye as I possibly could and look at it again and delve into some things.
Speaking of this empathy for human beings and letting their emotion come through, that moves me to the very next point I wanted to raise with you. This is a book. The cast, if you will, the dramatis personae, the people who appear, are many, and they include freed blacks, enslaved blacks of court, white, of course, white masters, poor whites, Indians. I mean, it's mm-hmm. the entire population of Manchester County, mm-hmm. Virginia at that time. Now, to sum it all up, Mr. Jones, I know this is a difficult question to sort of even try to phrase, but here's the sense of it. Reading all of this and thinking of what's going on, I got the impression that at least one moral lesson was that in a world that's constructed on evil, no matter what path people take, they're mm-hmm. all, no one is unscathed by it. Everyone is affected.
So many, even the good people are often pulled into it. And the best thing that you can do is try to keep your bearings about you. And one of the things I realized once that I had done this and it was finished was that without my even thinking about it, I felt that the people who did not limit themselves to the known world, their known mm-hmm. world, who saw a bit beyond what was in front of them, those are the people, for the most part, who could survive. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a slave named Elias who wants nothing more than to be free, and he takes many chances to try to escape until finally he can't do it anymore. And without even knowing it, he falls in love with this woman who is crippled and who can't possibly run. And what he finds in caring for this woman and in marrying her and having children with her is a kind of peace and freedom that he hadn't realized that he could have, being in slavery. And it was, I felt, that he was able to achieve this because he didn't limit himself to the world that he was given. Mm-hmm. Whereas the overseer on that plantation, Moses, a black man, he has limited himself in so many ways, and that in a way is his downfall.
I want to talk specifically about Moses as we continue, and I appreciate that point about Elias, and any book that we read in our own lives, we try to apply to our own lives if it moves us. And from what you've just said, I'm getting a notion that it's the dreamers who hold the future because they can live beyond whatever their known world is. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest was Dr. Edna Green Medford of the African Burial Ground Project at Howard University in Washington, D.C. We also heard excerpts from a conversation with author Edward P. Jones, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel, The Known World. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.